Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald. Kia ora and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday, the 5th of March. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, people, history, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight we continue our series from the Hutt Library's Heritage Collection on Eastbourne and the Waihini disaster of April 1968. The late St Albans vicar John Malcolm and his wife Valerie recalled the day of the Waihini disaster. We hear another short story from Catherine Mansfield's first book, Harry Dobby Reed's The Advance Lady. And we have original music from local musician Tom Dorman. So let's start the show off with some poetry from a new Hutt Zone contributor.
Alex Shearn, poem called Tomomi. Downwind of imperial tobacco, I took up residence on swampy ground, summiting this flight of stairs, immune to the cares that each day brings. Dishes lie unwashed in haste, as days drag on and on, strangers thrown together by events.
And that was Lower Hutt poet Alex Shearn reading his poem, Tomomi, A Street in Alicetown. Let's continue reading Catherine Mansfield's first published book in a German pension with Bookstream audiobooks narrator Harry Dobby.
The Advanced Lady by Catherine Mansfield. Narrated by Harry Dobby.
Do you think we might ask her to come with us? Said Fraulein Elsa, retying her pink sash ribbon before my mirror. You know, although she is so intellectual, I cannot help feeling convinced that she has some secret sorrow. And Lisa told me this morning, as she was turning out my room, that she remains hours and hours by herself, writing. In fact, Lisa says she is writing a book. I suppose that is why she never cares to mingle with us, and has so little time for her husband and the child. Will you ask her? Said I. I have never spoken to the lady. Elsa blushed faintly. I have only spoken to her once, she confessed. I took her a bunch of wildflowers to her room, and she came to the door in a white gown, with her hair loose. Never shall I forget that moment. She just took the flowers, and I heard her, because the door was not quite properly shut. I heard her, as I walked down the passage, saying, Purity, fragrance, the fragrance of purity and the purity of fragrance. It was wonderful. At that moment, Frau Kellermann knocked on the door. Are you ready? She said, coming into the room and nodding to us very genially. The gentlemen are waiting on the steps, and I have asked the advanced lady to come with us. Now, how extraordinary, cried Elsa. But this moment the Gnade Frau and I were debating whether... Yes, I met her coming out of her room, and she said she was charmed with the idea. Like all of us, she has never been to Schlingen. She is downstairs now, talking to Herr Erchart. I think we shall have a delightful afternoon. Is Fritzi waiting too? Asked Elsa. Of course he is, dear child. As impatient as a hungry man listening for the dinner bell. Run along. Elsa ran, and Frau Kellermann smiled at me significantly. In the past, she and I had seldom spoken to each other, owing to the fact that her one remaining joy, her charming little Karl, had never succeeded in kindling into flame those sparks of maternity which are supposed to glow in great numbers upon the altar of every respectable female heart. But, in view of a premeditated journey together, we became delightfully cordial. For us, she said, there will be a double joy. We shall be able to watch the happiness of these two dear children, Elsa and Fritz. They only received the letters of blessing from their parents yesterday morning. It is a very strange thing, but whenever I am in the company of newly engaged couples, I blossom. Newly engaged couples, mothers with first babies, and normal deathbeds have precisely the same effect on me. Shall we join the others? I was longing to ask her why normal deathbeds should cause anyone to burst into flower, and said, Yes, do let us. We were greeted by the little party of cure guests on the pension steps with those cries of joy and excitement which herald so pleasantly the mildest German excursion. Herr Eschert and I had not met before that day, so, in accordance with strictest pension custom, we asked each other how long we had slept during the night, had we dreamed agreeably, what time we had got up, was the coffee fresh when we had arrived at breakfast, and how we had passed the morning. Having toiled up these stairs of almost national politeness, we landed, triumphant and smiling, and paused to recover breath. "And now," said Herr Eschert, "I have a pleasure in store for you. The Frau Professor is coming to be one of us this afternoon. Yes," nodding graciously to the advanced lady. "Allow me to introduce you to each other." We bowed very formally, and looked each other over with that eye which is known as eagle, but is far more the property of the female than that most unoffending of birds. "I think you are English," she said. I acknowledged the fact. "I am reading a great many English books just now. Rather, I am studying them." "No," cried Herr Eschert. "Fancy that! What a bond already! I have made up my mind to know Shakespeare in his mother tongue before I die. But that you, Frau Professor, should be already immersed in those wells of English thought." "From what I have read," she said, "I do not think they are very deep wells." He nodded sympathetically. "No," he answered. "So I have heard. But do not let us embitter our excursion for our little English friend. We will speak of this another time."
"No, are we ready?"
cried Fritz, who stood, supporting Elsa's elbow in his hand, at the foot of the steps. It was immediately discovered that Karl was lost. "Karl! Karlchen!" we cried. No response.
"But he was here one moment ago," said Herr Langen, a tired, pale youth, who was recovering from a nervous breakdown due to much philosophy and little nourishment. "He was sitting here, picking out the works of his watch with a hairpin." Frau Kellermann rounded on him. "Do you mean to say, my dear Herr Langen, you did not stop the child?"
"No,"
said Herr Langen. "I've tried stopping him before now."
"Duh! That child has such energy, never is his brain at peace. If he is not doing one thing, he is doing another."
"Perhaps he has started on the dining-room clock now," suggested Herr Langen, abominably hopeful.
The advanced lady suggested we should go without him. "I never take my little daughter for walks," she said. "I have accustomed her to sitting quietly in my bedroom from the time I go out until I return."
"There he is! There he is!"
piped Elsa, and Karl was observed slithering down a chestnut tree, very much the worse for twigs.
"I've been listening to what you said about me, Mama," he confessed, while Frau Kellermann brushed him down. "It was not true about the watch. I was only looking at it, and the little girl never stays in the bedroom. She told me herself she always goes down to the kitchen and..."
"Duh, that's enough," said Frau Kellermann.
We marched en masse along the station road. It was a very warm afternoon, and continuous parties of cure guests who were giving their digestions a quiet airing in pension gardens called after us, asked if we were going for a walk, and cried, "Herr Gott, happy journey," with immense ill-concealed relish when we mentioned Schlingen.
"But that is 8 kilometres, shouted one old man with a white beard, who leaned against a fence fanning himself with a yellow handkerchief.
7.5, answered Herr Eschert shortly.
8, bellowed the sage. 7.5. 8.
The man is mad, said Herr Eschert.
Well, please let him be mad in peace, said I, putting my hands over my ears.
Such ignorance must not be allowed to go uncontradicted, said he, and turning his back on us, too exhausted to cry out any longer, he held up 7½ fingers.
8!
Thundered the greybeard with pristine freshness. We felt very sobered, and did not recover until we had reached a white signpost which entreated us to leave the road and walk through the field path, without trampling down more of the grass than was necessary. Being interpreted, it meant single file, which was distressing for Elsa and Fritz. Karl, like a happy child, gambled ahead and cut down as many flowers as possible with the stick of his mother's parasol, followed the three others, then myself, and the lovers in the rear. And above the conversation of the advance party, I had the privilege of hearing these delicious whispers. Fritz.
Do you love me?
Elsa.
No, yes.
Fritz, passionately.
But how much?
To which Elsa never replied, except with, how much do you love me? Fritz escaped that truly Christian trap by saying,
I asked you first.
It grew so confusing that I slipped in front of Frau Kellermann and walked in the peaceful knowledge that she was blossoming and I was under no obligation to inform even my nearest and dearest as to the precise capacity of my affections. What right have they to ask each other such questions the day after letters of blessing have been received? I reflected. What right have they even to question each other? Love which becomes engaged and married is a purely affirmative affair. They are usurping the privileges of their betters and wisers. The edges of the field frilled over into an immense pine forest. Very pleasant and cool it looked. Another signpost begged us to keep to the broad path for Schlingen and deposit waste paper and fruit peelings in wire receptacles attached to the benches for the purpose. We sat down on the first bench, and Karl, with great curiosity, explored the wire receptacle. I love woods, said the advanced lady, smiling pitifully into the air. In a wood, my hair already seems to stir and remember something of its savage origin. But, speaking literally, said Frau Kellermann, after an appreciative pause, there is really nothing better than the air of pine trees for the scalp. Oh, Frau Kellermann, please don't break the spell, said Elsa. The advance lady looked at her very sympathetically.
Have you, too, found the magic heart of nature? She said.
That was Herr Langen's cue.
Nature has no heart,
said he, very bitterly and readily, as people do who are over-philosophized and underfed.
She creates that she may destroy. She eats that she may spew up, and she spews up that she may eat. That is why we, who are forced to eke out an existence at her trampling feet, consider the world mad and realize the deadly vulgarity of production.
Young man, interrupted Herr Ehrschardt, you have never lived and you have never suffered.
Oh, excuse me, how can you know?
I know because you have told me, and there's an end of it. Come back to this bench in 10 years' time and repeat those words to me, said Frau Kellermann, with an eye upon Fritz, who was engaged in counting Elsa's fingers with passionate fervour. And bring with you your young wife, Herr Langen, and watch, perhaps, your little child playing with... She turned towards Karl, who had rooted an old illustrated paper out of the receptacle and was spelling over an advertisement for the enlargement of beautiful breasts. The sentence remained unfinished. We decided to move on. As we plunged more deeply into the wood, our spirits rose, reaching a point where they burst into song. On the part of the three men, O Welt, wie bist du wunderbar? The lower part of which was piercingly sustained by Herr Langen, who attempted quite unsuccessfully to infuse satire into it in accordance with his world outlook. They strode ahead and left us to trail after them, hot and happy. Now is the opportunity, said Frau Kellermann. Dear Frau Professor, do tell us a little about your book.
Ugh, how did you know I was writing one? She cried playfully.
Elsa here had it from Lisa, and never before have I personally known a woman who was writing a book. How do you manage to find enough to write down?
That is never the trouble, said the advanced lady. She took Elsa's arm and leaned on it gently.
The trouble is to know where to stop. My brain has been a hive for years, and about 3 months ago, the pent-up waters burst over my soul, and since then, I am writing all day until late into the night, still ever finding fresh inspirations and thoughts which beat impatient wings about my heart.
Is it a novel? Asked Elsa shyly.
Of course it is a novel, said I.
How can you be so positive? Said Frau Kellermann, eyeing me severely.
Because nothing but a novel could produce an effect like that.
Oh, don't quarrel, said the advanced lady sweetly. Yes, it is a novel, upon the modern woman. For this seems to me the woman's hour. It is mysterious and almost prophetic. It is the symbol of the true advanced woman, not one of those violent creatures who deny their sex and smother their frail wings under...
The English tailor-maid? From Frau Kellermann. I was not going to put it like that.
Rather, under the lying garb of false masculinity.
Such a subtle distinction, I murmured.
Whom, then? Asked Fräulein Elsa, looking adoringly at the advanced lady. Whom, then, do you consider the true woman?
She is the incarnation of comprehending love.
But, my dear professor, protested Frau Kellermann, you must remember that one has so few opportunities for exhibiting love within the family circle nowadays. One's husband is at business all day and naturally desires to sleep when he returns home. One's children are out of the lap and in at the university before one can lavish anything at all upon them.
But love is not a question of lavishing, said the advanced lady. It is the lamp carried in the bosom, touching with serene rays all the heights and depths of...
Darkest Africa, I murmured flippantly. She did not hear.
The mistake we have made in the past, as a sex, said she, is in not realizing that our gifts of giving are for the whole world. We are the glad sacrifice of ourselves.
Oh, cried Elsa rapturously, and almost bursting into gifts as she breathed. How I know that! You know, ever since Fritz and I have been engaged, I share the desire to give to everybody, to share everything.
How extremely dangerous, said I.
It is only the beauty of danger, or the danger of beauty, said the advanced lady. And there you have the ideal of my book. That woman is nothing but a gift.
I smiled at her very sweetly.
Do you know, I said, I too would like to write a book on the advisability of caring for daughters and taking them for airings and keeping them out of kitchens. I think the masculine element must have felt these angry vibrations. They ceased from singing, and together we climbed out of the wood to see Schlingen below us, tucked in a circle of hills, the white houses shining in the sunlight.
For all the world like eggs in a bird's nest, as Herr Eschart declared.
We descended upon Schlingen and demanded sour milk with fresh cream and bread at the Inn of the Golden Stag, a most friendly place, with tables in a rose garden where hens and chickens ran riot, even flopping upon the disused tables and pecking at the red checks on the cloths. We broke the bread into bowls, added the cream, and stirred it round with flat wooden spoons, the landlord and his wife standing by.
"Splendid weather," said Herr Eschart,
waving his spoon at the landlord, who shrugged his shoulders.
"What? You don't call it splendid?"
"As you please," said the landlord, obviously scorning us.
"Such a beautiful walk," said Fräulein Elsa, making a free gift of her most charming smile to the landlady.
"I never walk," said the landlady. "When I go to Mindelbau, my man drives me. I've more important things to do with my legs than walk them through the dust."
"I like these people,"
confessed Herr Langen to me.
"I like them very, very much.
I think I shall take a room here for the whole summer."
"Why?"
"Oh, because they live close to the earth, and therefore despise it."
He pushed away his bowl of sour milk and lit a cigarette. We ate,
solidly and seriously, until those 7.5 kilometres to Mindelbau stretched before us like an eternity. Even Carl's activity became so full-fed that he lay on the ground and removed his leather waist belt. Elsa suddenly leaned over to Fritz and whispered, who, on hearing her to the end and asking her if she loved him, got up and made a little speech.
We wish to celebrate our betrothal by asking you all to drive back with us in the landlord's cart, if it will hold us.
Oh, what a beautiful, noble idea, said Frau Kellermann, heaving a sigh of relief that audibly burst two hooks.
It is my little gift, said Elsa to the advanced lady, who by virtue of 3 portions almost wept tears of gratitude. Squeezed into the peasant cart and driven by the landlord, who showed his contempt for Mother Earth by spitting savagely every now and again, we jolted home again, and the nearer we came to Mindelbau, the more we loved it and one another.
We must have many excursions like this, said Herr Erschart to me, for one surely gets to know a person in the simple surroundings of the open air. One shares the same joys. One feels friendship. What is it your Shakespeare says? One moment, I have it. The friends thou hast, and their adoption tried, grapple them to thy soul with hoops of steel.
But, said I, feeling very friendly towards him, the bother about my soul is that it refuses to grapple anybody at all, and I am sure that the dead weight of a friend whose adoption it had tried would kill it immediately. Never has it shown the slightest sign of a hoop. He bumped against my knees and excused himself and the cart.
My dear little lady, you must not take the quotation literally. Naturally, one is not physically conscious of the hoops, but hoops are in the soul of him or her who loves his fellow men. Take this afternoon, for instance. How did we start out? As strangers, you might almost say. And yet, all of us, how have we come home?
In a cart, said the only remaining Joy, who sat upon his mother's lap and felt sick.
We skirted the field that we had passed through, going round by the cemetery. Herr Langen leaned over the edge of the seat and greeted the graves. He was sitting next to the advanced lady, inside the shelter of her shoulder. I heard her murmur, "You look like a little boy with your hair blowing about in the wind." Herr Langen, slightly less bitter, watched the last graves disappear. And I heard her murmur, "Why are you so sad? I, too, am very sad sometimes, but you look young enough for me to dare to say this. I, too, know of much joy."
"What do you know?"
said he. I leaned over and touched the advanced lady's hand. "Hasn't it been a nice afternoon?" I said questioningly. "But you know, that theory of yours about women and love, it's as old as the hills. Oh, older." From the road, a sudden shout of triumph. Yes, there he was again, white beard, silk handkerchief, and undaunted enthusiasm.
"What did I say? 8 kilometres it is." 7.5, shrieked Herr Erschart.
"Why then do you return in carts?"
8 kilometres it must be.
Herr Erschart made a cup of his hands and stood up in the jolting cart while Frau Kellermann clung to his knees.
7.5.
"Ignorance must not go uncontradicted," I said to the advanced lady.
I'm John MacDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was Harry Dobby reading Catherine Mansfield's short story, The Advanced Lady, published in 1911, just 3 years after leaving Eastbourne. She left New Zealand on the ship Papanui to London in 1908. 60 years later was the sinking of the Wahine Ferry. Next, we'll continue the 2011 history series where Hutt City Council's Shelley Say made a series of interviews on the 1968 Waihini ferry disaster, talking to Eastbourne residents who helped on that day. And we hear more from Anglican Archdeacon John Malcolm and his wife Valerie on that stormy April day.
Son and Jean and I went off on a rather iffy sort of day to deliver Jean to school. Normally she would walk, but we were going to deliver her in the car. When we got to school, Muratai school, they said to us, go away, you know. They said, we're sending everybody home, the weather's no good. Now where St Albans was on the peninsula, we hadn't got very much wind at all. Mainly because the hillside was fairly close to us, and a cushion of warm air against the hill, and the wind was deflected. Actually, later on, we examined the garden to see what was damaged. One tamarisk tree was all that was damaged in the garden. It was, the top of it was knocked off.
That's at Albans, that's all. So were you aware of any stronger than normal storm when you woke up?
Well, when I was coming back from school, Christopher said to me, Daddy, is this a storm? And I said, no, I don't think so. Just a rather nasty day. So I delivered them home, and they turned the television on. It was giving just the radio broadcast on the television. So going back to the village, I met a child holding onto a lamppost.
As you do.
Yeah. And I said to her, what are you doing? She said, I can't walk. And she was not able to propel herself along the main street.
About how old would she have been?
6 or 7.
About 6 or 7.
Yeah.
And she was walking to school.
She was walking home.
You're walking home, yes, of course, that's right.
And she hadn't got very far. She just got as far as the main street. Her mother had a shop in the main street, and she was heading for Mum. So we got to the shop, and Mum said, I don't think anybody's ever coming in for the shop. I said, well, I'll leave you to sort things out, and I'll go and see the printer and come back. Well, I went down the Arua Street and went to the printer's shop, and we talked about the magazine. He said, there's a radio program on at the moment, sort of about the heads. There's a storm on, apparently, and there's a ship coming in, and it stopped. You can probably see it from here. And we had a look, went outside and did a general gander, and sure enough, there's a ship out there. And I said, oh, I was in Wellington when the Wanganella went on the rocks some years before, and I can remember that. It was stuck on Barrett's Reef for ages.
Can you tell me a little bit about that, what you remember from the Wanganella?
Only going down and looking at it from Seadune. We were holidaying in Lower Hutt, I think, at the time, Christmas holidays. Later on, when we went on this, they got it off, but it was a mess.
Did you? Yes, no loss of life, though, luckily.
No, none.
Did you grow up in Wellington?
No. But we often holidayed there, Christmas holidays. And then we went to Kilburnie Parish.
So your parish in St Albans, just to sort of fatten things out a bit about your involvement in the community at that time, roughly speaking, about how big was the parish? How many families?
Well, it was a parish that was 6 miles long and quarter of a mile wide, going from Point Howard through to Pencarrow. We reckon there were about 400 families.
And in that time that you were there, because you were relatively new there, weren't you? Time, what were the special areas that you got yourself involved in?
Well, the person before me was Edward Giles, who retired from the parish at 72 or 3, I can't remember which. He'd come out to New Zealand as a final assignment, if you like. He was a Franciscan. He was a delightful person, very sort of stern exterior, but a lovely big guy, and he'd asked for me to come. He'd sort of had a system where he'd invited various people to come and relieve in the parish while he was away, supposedly. I allowed the parish to be exposed to a whole lot of people, and when it came to for him to move, the parish asked me to go, mainly with his stimulus. Well, I was 30 and he was 70-something, so my emphasis was somewhat different. We were, Sunday school was one thing we paid attention to. We were chaplain to Wellesley College. We had the three churches in those days, St Albans, St Martin's, and St Columba's at Point Howard. We did sort of youth work. We ran holiday programs, all sorts of things like that. We also had people in to do a mission from time to time, sort of rev up. And then we invented a parish lunch at communion time, at confirmation time, beg your pardon, and the confirmees would have a slap-up meal, but it would be provided by their parents for everybody.
So nice.
And we levied everybody,
yes.
And everybody had a job. Each family had one job to do, either washing up the dishes or setting up the tables or something. And that was a very popular arrangement, and people felt involved, and it didn't matter where they came from. I can always remember taking one of my confirmation classes. A girl called Anoni McNabb arrived late, and she apologised for being late, but she said she got stuck on the way there, and she was, from the knees down, she was wearing bare feet and a very tight pair of jeans, which were slightly damp. She'd come by yacht.
She'd come by yacht?
Yeah, she'd have her little runabout. And she'd got stuck at Lowry Bay. She couldn't pack. And she'd come finally, she'd ditched it and walked along the beach.
That's
typical. You know, we did things like, there was a boat Mahina Bay. Mm-hmm. And the next one down.
Is it York Bay?
York, that's right. They built the boat, a lot of trouble. Beautiful hand-built boat, and they wanted this. And we had to search out a service for doing that. And there's a picture somewhere in
I think I've seen it in Julia Stewart's book on For Everything Its Season, and it's a history of Anglicans in Eastbourne, 1844 to 2009.
But we stopped the traffic because nobody could get in the way with a boat going in the water, could it? And we had to do it carefully and slowly, and it's great fun.
You broadened it to being very much a family community parish.
Yeah.
And Val, as the wife of the new minister in Eastbourne, what was your role to a large extent? Because you had young children. Eastbourne, the way you saw it when you arrived.
Well, we went to Eastbourne with two children. When we left 6.5 years later, we had five.
Which is the season.
We outgrew the vicarage, which was only a 2-bedroom house, unlike most vicarages which have to have now 4 bedrooms.
How did you manage?
Have you ever tried a child in a chest of drawers?
Yes. In fact, I think I spent some time myself in a chest of drawers.
We managed. We had a living room, which started off as the playroom for two children. And then we moved into the bigger room. Jean had one room and the boys had the other, two boys. Then Robin was born, so Robin slept with Jean. When we came home with number five, I said, I don't know where this one's going to go when it's too big for our bedroom.
Did you have support from the community in your
very much,
expanding?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was also a house, like a lot of houses out there, which had an outside wash house.
Mm.
So you had to go outside the back door onto a porch and then back up again. You've got small children and you've got to go out a door and go back again. One day I was going in the door and the front door was opened and Andrew was climbing in the door at the same time, the back door at the same time, and took the top off his finger. Mm. That was the sort of thing. But one of the vestry said, came in one day and I said, oh, excuse me, the washing machine's overflowing. I'm just going to go out and turn it off. And she said, what? She said, you mean to say you haven't got an automatic washing machine? And she promptly insisted to the vestry that we had to have an automatic washing machine.
Oh, how lovely.
But it was one of those ones with a ringer on the top.
Mm.
Mm. There had been one other family in the vicarage with children before us. But most of the clergy who went to Eastbourne were on the verge of retirement. So when we went there, having followed somebody that was on the verge of retirement, people just loved having a family around, you know. So there were families there, all right. No lack of families. It was just that that was the situation there. It was regarded as a retirement place.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
The people, I mean, the doctor was Dr. Martin, and he sort of adopted us and fussed around. We had a case of a croup, and he turned up about 12:15, and called up about 7 o'clock in the morning to make sure all was well. Really, quite ridiculous.
Can you remember his first name? Because I remember Dr. Martin, but I can't remember because I was only a child.
He was always called Panicking Martin.
Panicking Martin. Now, why was he called Panicking Martin?
He used to do this sort of thing. He'd worry about something and go and do it.
He'd shoot off. I know he helped with my parents enormously.
Yeah. There were two doctors in the area. They're both very nice.
What was the grapevine? How did the communication work? Who were the main players as far as, I mean, to be yourself and your family, because you'd be central to the Anglican community, plus, mm-hmm. I would say, mm-hmm. I think. What did you observe were the main way people got to know things happening in the community?
Well, all sorts of ways. Grapevine, of course. We had a parish magazine that came out.
The papers were good too.
And the paper was a good one.
Did people rely on that quite a bit?
Yeah, I think so.
I think they did, yeah.
Yeah.
The local rag, not the...
Yes, it was the Sun or something.
I can't remember what it was called. Yes.
Wainuia Matara, and it was run by an Eastbourne person, but it was all...
And how often did that come out?
I'm trying to remember. I used to write articles for it, so it came out once a month, I think.
And, of course, telephones, everyone had telephones, and radio.
Mm.
Did you notice that there was quite a lot of people listening to the radio that was the main source of their news, or did the Dominion and Evening Post get out to
radio? Oh, yes, they got out.
One of the communications was after we'd been there for a while, they set up Fish. Have you heard of Fish?
No, can you explain that?
Fellowship in Serving Him. It was a thing that the Roman Catholics and the Presbyterians
and the Anglicans
set up between them. Dorothy Archibald, who was a Days Bay person, said, why don't you call it Fish and run it like we used to run it in, where it was, Boston or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they sat together and talked about what they'd do. And there was a man who was a paraplegic, delightful Scotsman, he was a Presbyterian. He was willing to take on the phones. And so, because he's on his stomach all the time, his job was putting together terminals for radio. He was sort of busy, but he was not busy. Anybody could ring him at any time.
And everyone knew that you could always call him?
Yep.
Yes, he was the point of call. And then there'd be one or two people who would be sort of fill-in for him when he perhaps had to go to hospital or whatever, you know.
Yeah, but you have a delightful Scottish voice, would say, good evening, it is your fish operator here. At about that speed. And it was delightful because it was really calmed people down. It was neat.
So you contributed and you bound all the magazines in that?
Well, the Rona print bloke was a very helpful sort of guy. And in those days it was still typeset, so he used to take it into Wellington and come out with it and put it on the press. And it was a web offset. I was fascinated with his printing and had spent a lot of time to and fro in the shop. That's where I knew first, of course, of the Wahine disaster, in his shop.
They didn't talk about on the air, on the radio, they didn't talk about it being a disaster. They just said there's a ship coming through the heads and stopping.
Yeah, I know. I heard afterwards a person named Bridges, who was a police officer who had his home up in Highbury Road in Kelburn, looked out across the harbour and saw the ship stuck on, presumably something. He rang up the police and headquarters and said, I'm coming in later on, but we've got an emergency set up. Why don't we put it into action at once? It'd be a practice. And they said, don't be ridiculous, you know, being busy. So he was very cross, but he went into work anyway. And sort of when things developed a little later on, he sort of said, grief, what the heck do I, you know,
felt vindicated, but so what? I mean, so much could have been done.
Yeah, and he said, why don't I work for these blasted people who don't listen? But I didn't hear about that till afterwards. His daughter told me all about it. Dad was so angry, you know, around the house banging them all.
These stories are just coming out now, the reflected story, but a lot of people are actually talking about things. Well, since the last 7 years, these stories are coming out more and more, which is interesting.
Well, somebody wrote up the history of the disaster not long afterwards.
Yes, it's Max Lambert.
So whoever it was badly informed or...
Yes, I've spoken with Max. I have his book here. He's a journalist friend of my husband's, and I've met him on occasion, and he fully admits to that he didn't have that information. And, of course, he was very much following the tribunal findings and personal stories of survivors as opposed to what was happening on land. Because, again, why I'm concentrating so much on communication and communication in the community is because an issue was the communication with the police, of course, which is very different from now, but even then, communication between the Harbour Board and Robertson and between Seatoun and, of course, Eastbourne, all those sorts of things. So this is why I'm very interested in how people communicated in Eastbourne.
A lot of telephoning about.
Where did people congregate?
Well, they didn't. It was wet, unpleasant.
Normally, where would they congregate?
School.
Was there a pub or anything like
that? Yes, Eastbourne pub.
It was the school that they collected things at, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was still the main hub, the school.
Yeah.
Yep. And St Albans?
They didn't.
No, we didn't have anything much there, did we?
We had nothing.
Dorothy and the Blankets.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll get on the story.
I love stories about Dorothy because I knew her very well. and I know she was quite central to lots that was happening.
Dorothy's brother is John's mate. He was our best man at our wedding.
And his name is?
Robert. Robert William Reed Archibald.
Dorothy was quite central to the community.
Yeah.
And she...
She'd been going and coming to Eastbourne from where she was teaching in the States. Her mother hadn't been very well, so she came home again, forsook the chance of doing a PhD, and stayed and looked after Mum. And when Mum died, she stayed put. Bob went to Guy's Hospital and went from there to California. He worked at Stanford University. So that's how the family was. And Dorothy would go back to the States every couple of years or so, just to sort of touch ground.
And she was in Moana Road when she came back?
Yeah, until very recently.
Mm.
The house was built by Gray Young, the architect of Wellington Railway Station, and it was built in 1936.
Now, was she quite a strong member of the congregation?
When she was home, yes. We did a couple of things for the Sunday School, which were very special, which had come from the Episcopal Church in the States. Yeah, team teaching, all that sort of thing. And I got her to vet a publication I did for the virtually the Church's Education Commission, I suppose you'd call it, which I'd done on the sort of the influence of Sunday School and its attitude towards things, had on people of 20 to 30. And this was published. But she sort of read it and said, oh, heaven's sake, John, it's stodgy. So we rewrote the thing. She said, if I was writing a thesis for a PhD, I'd want to have some sort of points of view. So we set up four imaginary points of view and proved them or disproved them as we went. And it worked out quite well.
You had, with Sunday School, it was obviously very strong. You also had a youth group, did you not? Tell me about that.
Well, it really started from Edward Giles had called back the confirmation candidates for the 6 years. Each year he sent out an invitation on the anniversary, expecting them to come and witness at St Albans when the next confirmation was taking place. So we started off what we call the 17-plus group. That was in the very early days of our time there.
1965.
The first meeting, we had 70 invitations went out, because people had them locally.
Got a group of half a dozen teenagers, and then they found all the other kids.
And were they always in the Eastbourne Days area?
Yeah.
They weren't people from the Hutt or Petone?
Not really, no.
No, they were the locals?
No, they decided not to send the invitation beyond.
And we had it at the vicarage.
Yep.
The first night...
Where?
The first night, 35 turned up... I used every cup in the house, including the children's bunny mugs.
Yeah.
But that's credit to the strength of the parish.
Yeah, and you had to be adaptable.
Yes, you had to.
Over the years, twice I had children the next day.
And Dorothy was very special to the family. She came in and babysat for
us. She shared a bed with Jean one time I was in hospital.
That was Robin, yes. And it was on her phone in Eastport, in Dace Bay, that we rang Bob at Guy's Hospital and got him to agree to be
Andrew's godfather.
Godfather Andrew.
You're your second son.
Yeah.
Yes, our second son.
I'm getting that. And this 17-plus group, was it mainly boys or was it boys and girls?
No. Mixture.
It was like a Bible class.
Oh, yeah, like a Bible class.
But we didn't call it that.
No.
The kids who were in the... Because they didn't go to school in Eastbourne.
No.
And so they went out to school. But there was a little group of university students, including Graham Bellamy, because... what's his name? John Bellamy.
Yeah.
Was headmaster at Wellesley College. And Graham was one of our teenagers, older teenagers. John Black is now a bishop. But he was teaching at Wellesley College at the time. He used to really get the kids going in terms of arguments. All the kids were very much involved. I mean, some of them were. They didn't go to university. They're school shopkeepers, you know, worked in shops and things. But they still were part of the group.
Can you remember some of the names of the teenagers at the time of April the 10th? That were in the 17-plus group?
On the morning after we'd rescued the little girl, she and her mother and her sister came in my car along the coast road, Arua Street.
He took them home.
Yes.
And we sort of waited for the waves to go back and drove on, you know. That sort of a journey. It's quite exciting.
Were the girls frightened?
Yes, I think so. But they didn't say anything. They were silent, which was strange. They were them home, and I sort of went back to the printer and to find more news, told Val what I'd done on the way past, checked up, and I decided not to go back along the coast. Oh, talked to Maury, Maury Ballinger, town clerk, and he was sort of setting up things. He said, looks as though people are coming ashore at Pencarrow. We'll have to set up some sort of arrangements for that. About 9:30, 10.
As early as that?
He was on the ball.
I'm Jim McDonald and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was the late Archdeacon John Malcolm and his late wife Valerie sharing their memories on the Eastern Bays Anglican Diocese and Wahine Day, with Hutt City Council's Shelley Say. It was recorded in 2011, and part 3 plays next Thursday. Thank you to the Library for making that interview available on the Recollect platform. Sadly, that's all we have time for this week's show. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can always listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hut Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a suggestion of a Hut story or a piece of music or poetry, then please do message us, either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team, and our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. Let's go out with some music from local musician Tom Dorman, I'm Still Young. Until next Thursday, mate wa e noho oru mai ra, stay well.
I'm not quite yet the man that I want to be. Since plotting my course when I was 23. I made my decisions for better or worse. I'll share my lessons, regrets I'll disperse. And who's to say how this What's between the atoms we can't comprehend? And I'm still young, and I'm doing the best that I can. Like the tide, I'll keep chasing the moon till I reunite with the sun. I'm not quite yet the man that I want to be. Still a scared little boy a few trips from 43. And all hearts will break, I've got blood on my hands. My life is mine, never yours to command. I've let my life get taken off course, but I still hold the reins of this wild horse. And oh, that I've brought to life. I'm still young, and I'm doing the best that I can. Like the tide, I'll keep chasing them on until I reunite.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.